Welcome, 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 everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Really glad to have you here again for episode 9 of season 2 From the Point. I'm Danny Lambert. And as always, it's a pleasure to have you here as we get ready to discuss another great hockey book this week. But as always, you know, before we get into that, just a little bit of a warm up to get us, you know, warmed up for the show and in the mood for hockey. I think my takes from this week are pretty simple. If you need a reason to believe in humanity again, the Buffalo Sabres won Wednesday night. Sure, they beat the Flyers, who are their own brand of dumpster fire right now. But a win's a win, and it's nice to know that the Sabres won't go down as quite the worst team ever, although that's certainly debatable at this point. Still, when you look at it, the win is one thing, but this team still has significant issues. But, I mean, when you look at what is ahead on the road ahead, I'm inclined to agree with something I heard from Ray Ferraro the other day, that his brother-in-law, Don Granato, is going to do pretty much everything that he can to at least turn the culture of that dressing room around in the short term. And it should yield some dividends in the long term. So I'm hopeful, but we'll see what happens. And if you're a Sabres fan, stay hopeful. I think there are better things on the horizon for you. Also from this week, I was really happy to see the Habs get back to action after their COVID layoff. That's never a good thing. As a big Wild fan, that was not fun to watch either when my team did that. And of course, the Habs came back, almost seemed to be really rested and stronger than ever. They had a big win over the Oilers. But say what you will about that hit that McDavid had on Kotkaniemi. To me, it was more of a frustration move. It wasn't really a hockey move. He wasn't really doing anything to change the game by doing that. But in the end, what's done is done. You know, you can't really change that, the punishment dealt out or what you think about it. But I would challenge anybody to tell me that that was not done out of frustration. So, but I think it's really that point that I really actually want to start the show with, because this week's episode is really best started off in talking about hits to the head, because that's a lot of what the book that we're featuring this week is going to be about. In hockey and in life, perhaps the most valuable organ in the body is the brain. And as we've talked about on the show in a few past episodes, the correlation of hockey and brain injury have definitely come to the forefront of the collective hockey consciousness over the last few years, especially. The idea that playing the sport, that players can play the sport they love and can permanently damage themselves for life, is something that for years was often thought to be simply an issue that was related to other body parts like knees, shoulders, backs. And the brain was often overlooked. It's simply not an issue. You got your bell rung. You seem okay now, but not really thinking about, are there any lasting effects? But when it became apparent that there was a correlation between players who had received excessive hits to the head and brain trauma due to hockey, some of those, and then you started watching some of those players have issues with things like impulse control and other lingering effects known to be associated with brain injury, the problem just really can't be overlooked anymore. And like I said, we've even gone over in this show a couple major examples of that already. Most people today are aware that the fact that hits to the head sustained while playing hockey can cause brain injury. There's not much debate about it. The science backs it up. But what I think is lost on most is a sense of urgency to change the game to better prevent these injuries, and also a cohesive plan to change the game in order to ensure that these brain injuries are reduced. Hall of Fame goaltender Ken Dryden has thought about these issues and how brain injury occurs in hockey and what we could possibly do to prevent it. In his 2017 book Game Change, The Life and Death of Steve Montador and the Future of Hockey, Dryden lays it all out for the reader to understand the issue from beginning to end. He uses the story of the former NHL defenseman Steve Montador to give you a look in a case where a player's brain injuries were just too much, and puts a human face to the entire issue that really helps you understand and go along on the journey into what head injuries are doing to different players. While doing that, he also shows the science behind what happens to a person, and more specifically a hockey player who suffers a major brain injury, and then goes a step further to suggest how we may prevent it in the future. It's a powerful book written by a true scholar and a student of the game, and I'm happy that we're going to discuss it as this week's book. It's a complex book with a lot of information on a powerful subject. So with all that said, let's get everything started and get into the warm-up, which is up after this.
Headshots, fighting, hard, fast hits. Hockey is a tough sport, but that shouldn't have to mean that you take your life into your hands when you play it, especially as it relates to head injuries. Ken Dryden is a six-time Stanley Cup champion, member of the Hall of Fame, former federal cabinet minister, and now the author of Game Change, The Life and Death of Steve Montador and the Future of Hockey. And number 29 joins us now for 29 minutes right here on TVO. Nice to have you here.
Thanks, Steve.
It is unusual, Ken, to start a book about somebody by confessing you really don't know this person at all and frankly aren't even sure you remember having seen them play on the ice. But here you go. This is how the book opens. I never met Steve Montador. When I heard the news of Steve's death, I wanted to know how and why a 35-year-old, recently retired hockey player had died. This is Steve's story of a game, where it began, how it got to be where it is, where it can go from here, and how it can get there. I suspect almost everybody remembers your first book, The Game, many years ago, which in a sense was a kind of a love letter to hockey. If that was at one end of the continuum, is this at the other end, the kind of cautionary tale?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think of it that way, anyway. And I also don't like cautionary tales. I like aspirational tales. And that's why I wrote this book, and that's why the last chapter is the longest chapter in the book by far, because it suggests a path towards an aspiration. I think, you know, cautionary tales are interesting. They tell us what might be, but they don't tell us how to get away from what might be.
And you want us to get there.
And I want us to get there. I have no interest in wallowing around in a dystopia, you know, in terms of the future. I want to get to a better place.
Pretty good clip there to go over what the book is exactly about, what the motivations were behind the book, from the author himself, Ken Dryden, talking there in that interview. And what I really thought was striking, and what you should take here, is he really didn't know Steve Montador, but he just was interested in his story, and I think that's really what cascaded into what the book became. So very good scholarly premise, very good sort of emotional premise to start off with. And I really think that when you hear why Dryden did it, it's kind of a neat thing to just hear that, hey, look, I wanted to find out what happened to this guy. And he sure did. And for us, I think we should be glad, because he made a great book and it's really informative and helps you think about this issue for sure. But thinking about the man himself that the book is based on, Steve Montador played 571 NHL games across 10 seasons for 6 different NHL squads. He was known as a shutdown defender who proved his mettle by posting a positive plus minus in 8 of his 10 NHL seasons. In his early 30s, he had signed a significantly large contract with the Chicago Blackhawks for the 2011-2012 season to be part of that exciting group that won a Stanley Cup in 2009 and 2010, and then went on to win 2 more cups in 2011-2013 and 2014-2015. His life was set, and he was ready to realize his dream of winning a Stanley Cup after working so hard as an undrafted free agent to get towards the top of the league's defenders. But concussions and their lingering symptoms kept him out of all except one of the Blackhawks' last 30 games of the 2011-2012 season. He'd try, but he'd never made it back to the NHL because of his concussion symptoms. Steve would be dead almost 3 years after his last NHL game was played. Friends and family all knew that Steve was having issues after those concussions in Chicago, those 3 rapid concussions that we're going to talk about later. His behaviors had changed. He had become a different person, and depression seemed to be an issue that really ruled his life. Try as he may, like many in his situation, Steve was losing a battle that was being waged inside his head. A battle he did not have the tools to cope with, really. Ken Dryden takes Steve's story and puts it to life. I read the book and I felt like I got to know Steve and his family very well because of the time and effort that Dryden put into telling his story. He puts a human face and story to the problem of brain injury in hockey, which makes you start to realize the damage with that brain injuries really take on players. And you start to realize that it's much more than you'd ever think, and it has a price, and it's a price that's paid far beyond just simply not being able to play the game. It affects you long after the game. Dryden also does a great job of discussing the life and death of Steve and making it sort of full circle. He attacks the issue really from two fronts. The first is that he explains the science behind brain injury and speaks directly with physicians who examine Steve's brain after his death to show you what physically happened to him. And number two, he really explains how the game of hockey started, has evolved into the sport that we see today, and what culpabilities it has in causing injuries to players like Steve and others. Also, in line with that thread, Dryden, as a former player and student of the game, offers possible solutions to fix the issues that are tied to brain injuries in hockey players, how the game can basically change, like the title of the book says. It's hard to read, but it's an important one. It's a hard read, but it's an important one, like many books I've encountered on this subject. So looking at how to approach the discussion for this week, I really wanted to start with Steve himself. What are the specific events and circumstances that led to his death? Much like when we talked about Derek Bogard in Boy on Ice, let's start with a look in the first period of what Steve could have done and what others could have done, and really ask the question, was all this really avoidable? So let's get ready as we approach these issues and hard questions with the first period, which is coming up right after this.
Steve Montador, we should just take a moment here and describe him, because you can be a big hockey fan and still not really know Steve Montador or recall having seen him play. A hockey player's hockey player. You sound like you really liked him by the time you've got to know him.
Yeah, I did. Steve was a guy who is on every team, I think, that has ever played. He's been on every 8-year-old's team, and he's been on every Stanley Cup champion, and he's been on the 31st place team in a league that is way out of the playoffs by the middle of April. He's somebody who is a pretty good player, but he's a far better teammate than he is a player. He's somebody who fills in. When there's a need, he tries to fill it. He was somebody who was described as a 5-6 defenseman. That means he would get about 15 minutes of ice time a game.
In a 60-minute game.
In a 60-minute game.
So not very much.
Not that much. But the better players need a rest. Like in baseball, it would be the equivalent of the starter that gives you innings. And so then you can get back to the top of the rotation where you've got the guys who win games. Well, Steve is somebody who would be on the ice to try to not lose you a game while the others, you know, are resting to go out then to win you the game.
And he made a good living doing that, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah. By the end, he'd signed a 4-year, multi-million dollar contract.
Yes, he had. And that was the triumph. I mean, it was an amount and a term that was longer than he ever imagined. He was always a kind of 1-year, 2-year contract player and earning a very decent amount of money. But finally, I mean, his triumph was his last contract was with the Chicago Blackhawks, who had not won the Cup the previous year but had won before that, were clearly a team that was going to be a contender in the future. And they were willing to sign him, first of all, and then to sign him for 4 years. And for the amount of money that they did, I mean, this was, you know, the message to Steve that finally he really had made it.
That was Ken Dryden again talking about exactly who Steve Montador was, just a little summation of his life and his career, and just what attracted Steve's story to Ken. I think it's a great way to start this period off, because that's where we're going to go. We're going to talk about the man himself and then sort of bring it into a discussion of what was going on with him. How could he have done things differently? Maybe how could people have done things differently around him to maybe prevent things? And then really also what was inevitable, what was unavoidable? And I think the journey that we're going to find is going to take and what we're going to find out from that journey is a lot like we have in the past episodes that we've talked about this subject, is that largely things were pretty unavoidable just based off of the injuries that Steve had sustained to his brain. But we're going to get into that as we go through the first period. So Steve Monitor, like, was a lot like all Canadian kids. He wanted to play hockey in the NHL when he grew up. His family was fairly well off and was able to give him the tools he needed to chase his dreams, so he was very lucky in that regard. He was not always the best player on the team, but he was the hardest worker, which kept him in the discussion as he rose up the ranks in junior hockey. He played for three different OHL teams and ended up being a 21-year-old non-drafted free agent at the time of his junior eligibility running out. Dryden explains that it might have been here in the largely unsupervised and crazy world of major junior hockey that some of Steve's issues might have began. Drinking and drugs started to creep in as Steve looked for outlets to the grind of the OHL season. At this time, he was able to keep up with things really largely at bay and still not let him bleed over into his playing time. It's just something, though, the substance abuse and the alcohol is something that Steve would struggle with up until his death. And the reason I think Dryden brings it up in the beginning of the book is to kind of show you that while Steve's injuries were there, there were still a little bit of things that were going on in the past. But as we'll find, it's usually not necessarily that that's the root cause. It's that things and impulses to do that become amplified because of the loss of impulse control that is associated with some brain injuries, especially CTE. Still, despite not being drafted, Steve was able to sign with the Calgary Flames, and as he had always done, worked hard to make an impact. He paid his dues in the AHL and then started to make his way into cracking the Flames lineup. It looked like he might have a future with the club, but it just seemed that things by the time of the 04-05 lockout had kind of run their course with the team and Steve. Monitor was tired of switching between the press box and playing. He asked for a trade, and Daryl Sutter saw fit to give it to him, as he understood that the Flames had little room for him and could trade him for some pieces that they actually needed. So they went ahead and dealt Steve to Florida in December of 2005. In Calgary, though, Steve had started to have some more serious issues with substance abuse that threatened to derail him. The lack of consistent playing time and making NHL money started to fuel Steve's issues with alcohol and drugs. He got the help he needed, though, and started to get right with a support system from friends, family, and teammates. After going to Florida, he would struggle a bit there with a relapse or two, but for the most part, after his time in Calgary, he'd keep things largely under control and tried to live a positive life and encouraged others to do so as well. Dryden talks about him doing things like reading The Four Agreements, which is a self-help book to help him sort of guide himself through life. So you really start to see that while Steve had his troubles with these things, he was definitely doing his best to try to keep him at bay. And like any other addict, you know, he had a few slip-ups here and there, but he was able to get his life largely under control. So substance abuse is really all you can say that is something of really of Steve's making. But let's bring up something that's in his background by this point in Steve's career: concussions. Steve, like many players, had paid so many dues to get to the NHL, he had suffered a few bell rings over the years, as you would call them. And like many players, he really couldn't recall how many of those bell rings he had received. As we all know, those bell rings are probably concussions. More importantly, though, you know as well as I do that means that there's a problem of brain injury, and it's already set in by this time in Steve's life, midway through his NHL career. And if you think about what you've read about others like, say, Bob Probert or Joe Murphy or anybody else out there, the impulsiveness and substance abuse is actually a symptom of the brain injuries. We've gone over that before. That's nothing new. I bring all this up, though, to say that as we look at Montador, even at an early stage of his career, you can see that the brain injury is likely present. So can you call this substance abuse really all completely his fault? Or can you blame it partly on the brain injuries and the lack of frontal lobe control? Steve was fortunate enough, though, he had a lot of people there to support him. As he had relapses or dealt with injuries, his support system was largely intact and worked. Still, he was alone at some points and needed to keep some ground himself in different ways by being spiritual and reading, like we talked about, reading the Four Agreements that he really took to heart. And I read it because of this book, to be honest. It's a decent read. It's got some good ideas in there. I can see why he enjoyed it. Still, like I said, relapses kind of just happened. But he stayed positive, and that was really the cornerstone of Monty and his journey. But still, in the end, his injuries just got to be really too much. especially his brain injuries. Now we'll move on, move the story up a little bit, and skip up to his last NHL season and the concussions that ended his career. He had a few more concussions before this, as we know, but in February of 2012, he suffered a severe concussion, and then another one quickly thereafter, and then another one after sitting out for a month. Three very rapid-fire big head injuries. He just wasn't really the same after that. Steve was able to come back the next season and play a few games in the AHL, and then after that, a few games in the KHL. But it was pretty obvious that by then the concussion symptoms had taken over and he just wasn't able to play anymore. It was said that Steve had suffered 19 concussions and probably many more that just weren't recorded or weren't evident by the time he hung up his skates. It was this in-between time that Steve began to take really a bad turn. So once again after the game, he leaves the game. His father, Paul, describes that in that time, quote, "Fortunately, he had never become violent, but he was very forgetful, and in his executive function and his decision-making was erratic and illogical and really exaggerated. He became aware of this, and everyone else around him became aware that this was becoming a very serious problem," end quote. So I think that's interesting that here it is, Steve understood a little bit about what was going on with him and everybody around him as well. So they were able to deal with it and sort of mitigate it as much as possible. But as we know, when you deal with severe brain injury, sometimes that's not knowing about it and trying to mitigate might not be enough in the end. You're kind of fighting a losing battle. But I think the reason Mondador's story kind of strikes me as a little bit different is the support system was kicking in a little bit better than, say, in the case of like Bogard, for example, who, as try as they may, they just couldn't get him to stay away from those painkillers, and that was what ended up being his demise. In the end, though, it just was too much for Monty. He tried his best, and he tried to keep it together, but lapses in judgment and control led to relapses and lingering symptoms. It just became too much for him. And eventually, he just, as his brother said, who found him on February 15, 2015, in his Mississauga home, he just sort of stopped breathing, and his heart gave out. He died of natural causes, but that was probably because his brain wasn't able to function as well as it used to and control those functions like it used to. Steve knew it and actually made arrangements. Steve kind of knew that things were going downhill, and he actually made arrangements for his brain to be studied after his death. Which led to the diagnosis that we all know now, that he actually had chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. So in the end, I think it's easy to make this statement after seeing CTE cases in many other players. Steve really didn't have a chance. Sure, he handled it better than others, but his head was a ticking time bomb, and his symptoms were really working against him. Although the NHL has responded to his death by officially calling it a lack of self-care, it's easy to see that his brain injuries were the cause of his death, and his brain injuries were sustained by playing hockey. It's really a matter of science, because Steve Mondador had CTE. Had Steve Mondador not had CTE, he wasn't going to have any issues. And that's, that was why he had issues. He had CTE. And that's where I want to pivot to for the second period, as we follow Dryden's formula and discuss how the effects of CTE can alter a person so much and how that applied to Steve specifically. So hang tight, we'll get into that in the second period after this.
Lately, it's been difficult to talk about football without mentioning concussions. Why? Well, mounting concern over a disease called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, more commonly known as CTE. In the world of medicine, CTE is a relative newcomer. In football, we just learned about it 10 to 15 years ago. Here's what we can say. It's a progressive degenerative brain disease. It is like Alzheimer's. It can start with memory loss, mood swings, and difficulty in concentration, developing into progressive dementia, even possible thoughts of suicide. But unlike Alzheimer's, CTE can also result in significant aggression and lack of impulse control. The big difference, symptoms tend to begin much earlier in life, closer to your 40s instead of your 60s. In both diseases, there's no known cure. Researchers believe there's only one way to get CTE, and that is repeated hits to the head. What happens is that you get a buildup of an abnormal protein called tau in the brain. Scientists do know both the location of the tau and how much tau in the brain determines the symptoms you might exhibit. But scientists don't yet have a magic number of hits that results in CTE. It also isn't known who exactly would develop CTE. There are some players who take many hits and never develop symptoms. Factors like genetics and age of exposure to the trauma could play a role. How do you know if you have CTE? Just because you have symptoms doesn't mean you have the disease. In fact, as things stand now, you can only be diagnosed for sure after death. Scientists are researching how to diagnose in living people. A prominent group of researchers have found over 90% of former NFL players have developed CTE. But remember something important here. The number could be so high because of something known as selection bias. That means the brains that were studied were from people who worried that they had CTE. Also, it's not just football players that need to be concerned. Boxers, soccer players, people in the military, anyone who's exposed to constant head trauma can develop it too.
That was a really great, quick, succinct clip that explains exactly what CTE is. You probably recognize that voice. It's Dr. Sanjay Gupta of CNN fame. While he talked mostly about football and some other sports in there and didn't really mention hockey, we all know that the hockey definitely causes CTE because we're talking about it right now with regards to Steve. And we've talked about it in the past with other players. So hopefully that gives you a little bit more into the science, because that's where we're going to go here. Because I think the science that's explained in Game Change is really important to the understanding of the story of Steve Montador at large, and then other players who receive diagnoses postpartum of CTE, and why it's important, what it affects, really. So you might have heard the term CTE before and been able to associate it with head injuries, but what exactly does CTE do to a person's brain and their life? According to Boston University's CTE Center for Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy, or CTE, is a degenerative brain disease found in athletes, military veterans, and others with a history of repetitive brain trauma. In CTE, a protein called tau misfolds and malfunctions, causes other proteins to misfold, and sets off a chain reaction where this malfunctioning tau slowly spreads throughout the brain, killing brain cells. CTE has been seen in people as young as 17, but symptoms do not generally begin appearing until years after the onset of head impacts. There is currently no way to find out if someone has CTE while they're alive. The only way to know definitively if someone has CTE or not is to slice segments of their brain and examine them under a microscope. Under the microscope, the evidence of CTE is quite clear, according to doctors, as the tau proteins add a milky color to the brain cross-section that is being examined, whereas a healthy brain cross-section appears clear and translucent. So it's pretty easy. So the research team that examined Steve Montador's brain, headed up by the renowned neurologist Dr. Charles Tater of the University of Toronto, knew fairly quickly that Steve had suffered from CTE when examining his brain. In that examination of Steve's brain, Dr. Tater was able to diagnose that Steve had likely suffered 19 concussions. That's where that number came from earlier, by simply looking at the trauma signs that were inside his brain already. It was clear that repeated blows to the head had caused Steve CTE and then his eventual death, as the degeneration of his brain spread around. Like we talked about at the beginning, those proteins spread around the brain and just wreak havoc, killing brain cells everywhere. The degeneration caused by the spread of the tau really is the issue. As tau makes its way across the brain, it can inhibit many functions. Most prevalent is the inhibiting of healthy function of the frontal lobe of the brain. The frontal lobe is often called the brain's filter and provides impulse control. This is obviously something that Steve struggled with. Now, is Steve's impulse control issues as pronounced as, say, like Derek Bogard? Hard to say, but he certainly was able to deal with them a little slightly better, but they were present, for sure. Additionally, though, when you look at the damage caused by CTE and the correlation between frequency of injury and effect, it can vary between individuals. Still, it's widely accepted that frequency is a factor, and also time between traumatic brain injury is a factor, definitely for sure. Looking at Steve's case, it can be surmised that the concussions he suffered in Chicago at the end of his career were, for lack of a better term, the nails in the coffin for his CTE. The damage probably was there before before those three concussions, but the fact that he suffered those three in such a short period of time probably did the most damage and tipped him over the edge, making his CTE worse and multiplied the spread of his degeneration. And you might be asking yourself at this point, how did doctors allow this to happen? It's hard to say, but Dryden pulls the thread by saying that it was largely ignorance. In the case of the 2012 concussions in Chicago, it can be said that doctors examined him, and each time they cleared him. They did their earnest work, and from what you can read in the reports, they were doing what they could with their tools. The issue, though, becomes, what were they doing? Were they trying to help put the player back on the ice? Were they doing what they knew was right? I think you can make that argument. It's really hard to say. I think the suggestion, though, that Dryden really, when he discussed this, is that they were just ignorant of the protocols. There weren't really great protocols in place, as we know back then from the league. And some of the players, it's been brought up, some of the team doctors really aren't neurologists, per se. They could be a specialist in an area that doesn't even get close to touching neurology. And it just, you know, allows for an ignorance where you don't really know what to look for as a doctor, and you don't know things like, hey, you need to give this injury more time to heal. It's not just the guy got his bell rung and he's okay now. Once again, it's hard to tell if it was ignorance or something else. It's really what it comes down to. But still, one thing's for certain, though. The science says what it says now. Steve had CTE, and he got it from brain injury sustained while playing hockey. The NHL and Commissioner Gary Bettman may not want to admit that, and they try to blame it on Steve. But the fact that his CTE was caused by playing in the NHL, they bear some responsibility to acknowledge that and to try to prevent it and care for people like Steve in the future. That's why many times you hear about aftercare for players really being a big subject of collective bargaining and other compensation packages pushed by the NHLPA, because this is a big thing. You want to watch after players after their playing career is done, much like with Steve. That's a thread I want to keep pulling on, though, as we transition into the final frame. In the third period, I want to pick up on the final theme that I feel that Dryden really tries to drive home in the book, and game change. And that's what the NHL can do to change the game to prevent brain injuries and ensure tragedies like Steve don't happen anymore, or at least not as frequently as you probably see now. In other words, doing a better job of being earnestly doing your best to prevent this. So stand by. That's what's up in the third period after this.
Richard Blumenthal is a U.S. senator, and he looked into this issue. And he asked Gary Bettman to get back to him on something, and Bettman wrote him, as you describe it in the book, a very lengthy single-spaced response. And here was part of it. This is the commissioner of the NHL saying, "The science regarding CTE, including on the asserted link to concussions, remains nascent, particularly with respect to what causes CTE and whether it can be diagnosed by specific clinical symptoms. The relationship between concussion and the asserted clinical symptoms of CTE remains unknown. At bottom, the science just has not advanced to the point where causation determinations can responsibly be made." I want to know if you've talked to Gary Bettman about this. I mean, you know the guy, right?
Yeah, I do.
Have you talked to him about this?
Yeah, I have.
And what's his response when you go at him on this?
Well, no, it would, you know, that is the response. And I mean, the thing that has surprised me through this is that we're of an age where we followed the tobacco story, we followed the asbestos story, the lead story, and some others that way. And so I understand those who are the proponents and what they're going to say, but what really surprised me was how you go from not knowing about something, and at a certain point we all don't know about something, then we know a little bit, but we don't treat it necessarily as seriously as some others do, and that's an understandable step. Then you may get to a point of kind of denying the connection when others are proposing it. then you defend it in various ways, and you have your experts up, even if they're not as expert as the other side or as many of them, but you defeat it that way. The step that surprised me, but shouldn't, is that the step of where at one point you are denying science, then you decide to say that, no, actually, I'm going to wrap myself in the flag of science and say, you know, we are modern scientific people, we are evidence-based people, and when science knows, then we will follow science. Mm. But science doesn't know. Mm. And of course, that's a fundamental misreading of science. I mean, science never knows. Science only knows the best it can at any particular moment. Science will know better tomorrow, and next week, and 5 years from now, and 10 years from now. But as a decision maker, what you do is you take the best of what science knows at any particular time, and you apply it in a manner that is consistent with the dimensions of the problem. That's what you do. And so, you know, that particular answer is not the best of Gary Bettman in the answers that he gives. I mean, it was a very defensive answer.
But I suspect...
Once again, you heard from Ken Dryden right there, and what I really found important with that segment is just that he knows very logically how to approach the argument made by Gary Bettman and the NHL. And I really like how he says that science knows, and you can't use science not knowing to discount, not knowing completely to discount what science already knows now. And I think that, you know, that what's even more telling is that Ken Dryden has said this to Gary Bettman before, it sounds like. I mean, it was pretty fairly clear he has. And one of the biggest paradoxes in NHL history is that Gary Bettman's done so much for the game, but Gary Bettman acts like a lawyer because that's where he's from and that's what he does. And in the issue of concussions and CTE, he's gone the lawyer route, and I think it's been to the detriment of players overall. And that's really what Dryden is sort of highlighting to you right there in that answer to that question and that thread that he puts up. But as we look in the third period, I really want to concentrate on some of the suggestions that Dryden gives in the book about how to change the game, because I think that's an integral part of the book is, as the title suggests, it's about the game change. What can we do in the future to make this better? One of the biggest threads of the book is he talks about the history of hockey and just the evolution of the game to where it is now. And then he mentions in that same interview that the biggest chapter in the book is how to change the game, and that's done for a reason. That's why he wanted it. He felt that was very important. So if you ever hear stories from long retired players, they'll tell you that the game in the NHL is faster than it ever was before. From the advent of competitive hockey, like many sports, the search for better ways to win are never ending, and it led us to a point where conditioning and competitiveness have made the game a more dangerous place in many ways. In Game Change, Dryden shows you that the game has evolved into a more violent and fast game. He walks the reader through the idea that the game has evolved to a point that has made the environment and the factors that have led to the injuries that have caused Steve and others to sustain brain injuries that lead to CTE. Sure, the game has always been violent from the beginning. I mean, nobody will deny that, and even Dryden brings it up in the book. But even in the days of, say, the rough guys that we talk about, the golden era of hockey, like, you know, for example, Gordie Howe, it wasn't even this rough. Howe and others really, you know, had a couple things going for them. They lived by unwritten codes that kept players safe from each other. They just had limits, and there were guardrails, there were norms. Even as vicious as Howe was, you knew he was known to warn players who were keeping their heads down to look up before he hit them. And that famous Gordie Howe hat trick that you hear so much about, you know, goal, assist, and a fight. You know that Howe only fought 22 times in his career and only had 2 Gordie Howe hat tricks in more than 2,400 games. This example with Howe is something that Dryden points to as a change in culture that makes today's game different. He certainly points out that Gordie Howe seems to be one of the roughest guys in hockey history, but he had his limits, and it wasn't like Gordie Howe was laying people out and injuring him on a daily basis. And if he did, it wasn't anything quite like what we see today. For example, if you remember, one of the hits that always sticks out in my mind, and it was a legal hit, was Scott Stevens laying out Eric Lindros. That is, watching that as a teenager was disturbing. But at the same time, we just see that that had a lot to do with just the way the game is now, speed, etc. So, and that's where, you know, one of the big threads that Dryden pulls on as well. The game is really fast. It happens with the advent of better skates, better equipment, better conditioning. Players are faster, so the things happen on the ice a lot faster. So, players are not able to defend themselves because they can't really see the play developing around them as much as they used to in, say, the times of, like, Gordie Howe. And then, B, you have interesting factor in that players have a hard time. Say they're going for a hit and then they see a guy change his back, he's already going way too fast to go ahead and, you know, turn. So what does he do? He finishes his check, puts him in the boards, and then we have some of the issues that we see with boarding, spinal cord injuries, big head injuries, etc. So and like I said, the equipment's kind of a double-edged sword. If you've ever noticed, equipment really, it'll keep you safe, but it also gives the other person the ability to be a little more lethal. So sure, the person getting hit can be safer by better equipment, but the other person who's doing the hitting can just be that much more carefree about things, because there, obviously, if you play the game, you know, there can be a price if you try to hit a guy. If you miss, that's one thing. You could end up hurting yourself, and even still, if you don't hit the right way, you can end up hurting yourself that way. So and the fact that players seem way more fearless because of their equipment, they put themselves in probably what would be more dangerous situations. So you really have to include that. And that's something that you really want to look at too, with the advent of equipment. And is the equipment doing what it needs to? Are the helmets protective enough? Are they the right ones? Are they doing the things? I know that especially when you look at baseball, they had a reckoning with this when it came to guys getting knocked off the head with their batting helmets, and you can see the improvements that they've made. And I know that the hockey has made improvements in their helmets over the years as well, but you wonder if it's the right improvements and if they're really helping to prevent those head injuries that we talk about. And then also along the lines of just, you know, another thing you have to think of is just, are you respecting your fellow player? Do you have enough respect for that person to know where your limits are? Sure, things happen, but one of the things, you know, and like I pointed out earlier, I don't want to make him a scapegoat because I think he's a really good guy, but like, look at what McDavid did to Kotkaniemi the other day. That was just, you don't need to do that. That was fear and straight frustration. And you see that a lot more. It ended up not being much of a thing, but it could have ended up being something. And that would have been really unfair to the player. So it's that code that I think that is a little bit lacking as well. And I know we kind of talked about it a little bit, but I wanted to, you know, it just popped into my brain. I'm like, hey, I don't think we quite got to all that. And then finally, one of the things I think is just really zeroing in on, and you know, Dryden talks about this, zeroing in on the hits to the head, making those more of an emphasis item. If you look at football, all leagues of football, for the most part, have made that a thing. The targeting penalty, like it, don't like it, whatever, it's a thing. And so what has happened is at first, most players rage against it. They say, well, what can we do? What we can't do? I can't even play anymore. But what you see as time goes on, you eventually learn how to live within that, the construct of those rules. But if you don't even try, how would things even change? And I think that has helped football get in a better headspace in that regard. And the fact that you can review it a little bit helps to realize that, hey, you can do what you want to on the football field, but when you hit somebody, you better watch out for their head, because there can be some serious consequences for you as the hitter. But of course, as we know, that you may not, in the heat of battle, you may not be interested in the consequences of the person getting hit in the head. So whatever gives you a moment of pause and whatever makes you think twice, I think that's a good thing. And maybe the NHL would be best served to have that happen as well. So, but whatever the changes are, there definitely needs to be some, because we can't accept this. It can't just keep going. You got to do something to try to change it. As we talked about, the NHL may deny the science largely behind it, or say that it's nascent and we need to wait for better, more definitive answers. But while we wait, things happen. The game's still being played. So it's kind of a situation of, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to be going with the most conservative response to help keep everybody safe, or continue to roll with it? And maybe a couple more people end up like Steve Montador or Derek Bogard. We don't need that. So I would urge everybody to think about these things a little bit as we go forward, you know, just at all aspects, fans, players, coaches, and the league, everybody. So that's really all I got to say about the third period. Hopefully there's some good ideas right there that went along with Ken Dryden's ideas to change the game. So we're going to get to the post game right now, wrap this up right after this.
Why bring in Dreisa? Why have you taken such a role in this injury? When you said for yourself you haven't had one, it's not something that maybe impacts you directly.
Well, I think, you know, for me, I mean, most recently, the death of Steve Montador, who was one of my best friends, and knowing, you know, Steve had 12 concussions, and in the latter part of his career, in the last few years of his life, he really struggled to, you know, live a normal life, to not be in pain, to struggle with depression, with addiction issues, with all sorts of things that, you know, I don't think one is independent of the other, but certainly, you know, that was a big part of his life in the game of hockey. So I feel like as a friend, a surviving friend, and many of our friends, that, you know, to keep Steve's legacy going and to just keep raising the awareness about mental illness and about concussion and brain injury as well.
That was a quick interview with Haley Wickenheiser, who was actually a good friend of Steve's and is mentioned in the book that in their Calgary days and the Calgary connections, you know, Steve actually worked out a lot and saw Haley, and Haley was always a very good friend to Steve. So hearing that interview, I was like, I have to play this on the show, because it's definitely a part of the book and something that you definitely think of. And it's to hear her thoughts on that and what their friendship meant to her, it's pretty important. Also, I'm a big fan of Haley's, if you didn't hear my episode on that already. So, but that being said, we're in the post game. Let's wrap this thing up and just kind of say that, like a lot of other tragic deaths, I mean, you look at Steve Montador, he was 35 years old when this happened, and you wonder, did it have to happen this way? One of the arguments you hear out in the world for sure is that, well, he was a hockey player. He knew what he was getting into, and he was getting compensated fairly well for it. Okay. While that may be true, in some sense, does it really mean that you should really abandon the person? Because as we saw after he got out of hockey, some of the post-care, the aftercare, really could have helped. But it wasn't there. You'll see examples if you read up on players that were like Steve, that, you know, people would reach out to the league or anybody else for aftercare, for help, and they wouldn't get it. Joe Murphy is a really good example of somebody who needed that aftercare and it just isn't getting it. Part of that is through his own problems, but that's because he can't think for himself. It's just really a hard thing to think of. But the reason I really like this book so much, and I think that it's something you have to pick up, is because Ken Dryden, as he explains to you, is very thoughtful in his examination of Steve Montador and just got to know him. It strikes me that answer is what he gives, with what the inspiration was for writing the book. And then really when he got to know Steve, he was somebody that he really thought he liked and would really wish he'd gotten to know, because that was just like I heard from John Branch when I talked about Boy on Ice and what he had to say about Derek Bogard. These are people. They're great people who didn't need to leave us like this, and we need to do them better. We need to try to make sure that their deaths weren't in vain, that they died for a reason, that we can go forward in hockey, we can change the game, as Dryden suggests, to make it better, to make sure that we don't have this happen. Because I'm telling you right now, if you read this book, you will become attached to Steve Montador. He was a good person. He was just like anybody else. And he was just trying to make a good life for himself. And it also sticks out to me that, right after he died, his son was born. He never got to see him. And that was because of this. So I just hope that what happened to Steve Montador doesn't happen again. We know the science behind CTE. I just explained it in the second period. It's out there. You can read about it. Now, if you want to talk about how developed the science is, sure, okay. But there's a lot of smart people thinking about this right now. And they'll tell you that this is a thing. And I just, really want to say that now this is probably the third book I've featured on brain injuries and effect on a player and a person, and you just feel for the people. They can't stop themselves. They can't change their environment because of the injuries that they've sustained. It's one thing if you hurt your knee and you limp around for the rest of your life. You learn how to deal with it. Your brain teaches you how to deal with it. But what happens if your brain gets hurt and you don't have the capacity, because it's being taken from you, to know how to get around that? Really an interesting question, but I don't want to be too much of a downer. Really, I want to leave this with a hopeful thing, and just say that if you go out and you read Game Change, hopefully you'll learn, like I have, that this is something when you watch hockey that you got to be aware of, and you have to look at a critical eye and not just always be like, well, that hit was cool. Well, was it a good hit? Was it something that should have happened? Anyways. Phew, okay, I think that's it for this week, for sure. Really, as always, just want to thank you for listening. It's too much fun to do this, and I hope that you have fun listening, because it's always massively appreciated when you do listen. I can't say enough. It humbles me to know that there are people that listen to this show every week. Also, if you like what you heard, as always, please take a moment to give me a good rating and a follow or subscribe on your favorite place for podcasts. Really helps grow the brand and get the show out there. So please take in a little extra time. It's much appreciated. And if you want some awesome facts, like we always talk about the featured book for the week, give us a follow on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, as I post pretty much every day a factoid about the book that we're reading. So that'll be a good thing. Please try to do that. Oh, and if you've got suggestions and you just want to contact me or give me some kudos, please be nice, though, if you got something to say. As I always point out, this is a positive place, at least I hope so. The email for the show is fromthepointpodcast16@gmail.com. So, as always, this is the part of the show where I start to leave you, but I give you a preview of next week. I just want to bring this up right now. I've got a few things going on next week. I won't be able to record the show, so I'm going to take a break next week, but I'll be back the week after, I promise. Stronger than ever, as always, with a new book. And that book's going to be, that book is going to be Crossroads, by Caleb Dahlgren, who was one of the, surviving members of the Humble Broncos, bus crash. It's a great book. It's a huge human journey. And I enjoyed every minute of reading Caleb's story, and I think you will too. It's a recent book and it's a great book. So, like I said, in 2 weeks, get ready for that. We'll be talking about Crossroads. Until then, take care, hockey fans, and let's stay classy out there.